Hello and welcome to Blockchain Gaming World, episode 136. I'm your host, John Jordan, and joining me today we have Niraj Kashyap from Moonstream. How's it going, Niraj?
It's going well, John. How are you?
I'm good, good. You're just so people know, you're moving at the moment, so you have some boxes in the background. It's not your typical living conditions.
Yeah. Well, I've been moving in for the last couple of months, but I've been traveling a lot as well, so I haven't.
It's one of those, is it? Yeah, you find you have boxes from the last place you moved from to ago.
Yeah,
I've been there. Yeah. Cool. so we're going to talk about what Moonstream does. Unlike a lot of the people I have on the podcast, you're not a game blockchain game developer. You are you call yourself the economic infrastructure for Web3 games. So that's going to be interesting to dig a little bit into sort of what that means and what you. Do for games. You work with some pretty high profile games, so Crypto Unicorns we had on a couple of episodes ago, and Champions Ascension, one I'm really interested in, and I'm sure a whole bunch more we can talk about. But before we dig right into that, let's get a bit of a product history about you. So as much detail as you sort of want, really, but how did you get into sort of this blockchain game infrastructure business, which is, you know, still pretty novel?
Actually, we sort of got into blockchain gaming infrastructure accidentally. I've been involved in crypto since 2016. Mm-hmm. I'm originally a mathematician, and that's sort of how I got into crypto in the first place. Even the Bitcoin white paper. I was in grad school when the Bitcoin white paper came out, and it made the rounds through the mathematical community and the computer science community pretty early on. Yeah. And at the time, I didn't find it very interesting, actually. I wish I had. I was doing pure mathematics, and anything that touched a computer was of very little interest to me at the time.
Yeah, okay.
But at least I was familiar with the ideas. And what really excited me was when Ethereum launched. They were selling themselves as the world computer. Mm. And that was very exciting to me compared to just a decentralized ledger for transactions. Actually being able to execute computations, with shared state, that was super exciting to me. And that's when I started taking crypto very seriously. I really got involved around 2016, just running my own infrastructure, running nodes, stuff like that. And then I've just gradually moved my way up the application stack to, to actually be building applications on top of, we're focused on EVM blockchains. And the way that we got into Web3 gaming is if you're running a node, okay, you can make money by mining blocks or validating blocks or whatever. But there's also a lot of other opportunities when you're running your own infrastructure to monetize it. And the clearest way is to offer analytics as well, right? So okay. If you're running nodes anyway, you can crawl data from your nodes and offer analytics to different people. And that's how Moonstream started. So Moonstream started as an analytics product. And our first customers at Moonstream, we had two types of customers. We had games, Web3 games. This was in summer 2021. And we had traders. And very early on, we realized that we didn't really like serving traders as a user base or as a customer base. They're very fickle. There's very little loyalty. And ultimately, you're not going to make much money off of them. That was very clear early on. And games were great customers. Almost everyone on the team is an avid gamer, and so it was something that we had a lot of affinity for, just naturally. And so that's how we got into Web3 gaming and providing infrastructure. We just started off by providing analytics. Okay. Our first customer was actually Crypto Unicorns.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were our first paying customer for analytics, and just over time, they started with us and we started with them when both of our projects were very young. So they were using us before their launch. They used us through their launch. And sort of because we have a pretty close relationship with them, we saw firsthand the kind of difficulties that they had in maintaining their economy. Mm-hmm. And we had very natural solutions to those problems, with the smart contracts that we had and that we had created. So for example, the Crypto Unicorns game launch, it was supposed to launch in February of 2022. And it was pretty clear, around December, I still remember we talked on Christmas Eve and they were okay, this is probably going to be delayed. What do we do? Hmm. We had over 3 days, we and them together came up with this idea of running like a fully on-chain game called Crypto Unicorns the Dark Forest, and we launched it on January 28th of 2022. Mm. It ran for 2 months, and I think to date it's the most successful on-chain game ever. I mean, there's more hyped on-chain games like Dark Forest.eth and so on.
Yeah.
But in terms of raw transactions, like that game did almost 2 million transactions on Polygon mainnet, right, in the 2 months that it ran. Like 92% of the players, like the Crypto Unicorns player base, engaged with that game, right? And at that time, that player base was very substantial. So it's just through events like that and through activities like that, we sort of like discovered what the economic needs are for Web3 games. And I think in the future, these are economic needs that are gonna serve like just digital communities that that live on Web3. And we tailored our product to actually like fulfill those needs.
So when you say kind of analytics, then that's obviously sort of looking at sort of data and, you know, we've had that in the games industry for a long time, obviously not on blockchain, but, you know, people sort of always want to log how many people have downloaded the game, how they logged in, what's your, you know, these retention mechanics, how many people are logging back in after day 7, day 30, whatever, and obviously monetization. We've had that particularly in free-to-play mobile. There's very sort of deep tech stack around that. I guess for blockchain and the fact that with Moonstream, you do specifically say you're sort of the economic infrastructure, it's actually not necessarily more complicated in terms of the data. I mean, you have a lot more data, but it's more interesting and because you have sort of the data of what players are doing and then the data about what players are spending. And obviously there's probably some correlation between a player who's playing a lot, maybe spending a lot, but equally some players who don't play very much are spending a lot. So you have this kind of quite potentially a sort of orthogonal thing going on there, and it's very different to what we've seen before. So I guess you sort of, when you say analytics, to me that seems a bit like you're doing, I don't know, like a dashboard that people look at and see what's going on. But the economic bit, and it sounds like you're doing with Crypto Unicorns, is much more sort of like sort of customized sort of co-dev or consulting or something. I mean, on that sort of spectrum, sort of where do you sit? Is it how you sort of work with companies?
Actually, we try to avoid any kind of co-development or consulting.
Oh, you do? Okay.
You know, analytics is the starting point, but ultimately analytics are not really useful if you can't act on them and if you can't act on them in a sufficient amount of time, right? And when you're talking about like a Web3 economy, a sufficient amount of time might not be very long. You might have to act on the analytics very quickly. And so, you know, although we started off just with analytics, we realized very soon that we had like... Let me sort of explain it to you this way, okay? So if you're running an economy, like, you know, you can sort of think of it in an analogy as like a very complex machine, right? Like maybe like a steam engine, but a complex steam engine, like some sort of like a Rube Goldberg steam-based contraption where you have like, you know, you want to keep the system in equilibrium or you want to keep it growing at like, you know, some reasonable rate, let's say economic equilibrium. But at any given point in time, because there's no central control on how players in the economy are acting, you can have like, you know, different parts of the machine can sort of go out of whack. Like maybe too much pressure can build up over here, or you might be losing too much like pressure in another location. And basically the challenge of a community, depending on how decentralized a game is, it could be the challenge of like, you know, a single game design team, or it could be a challenge for a DAO, or it could be just a challenge for the community as a whole. Is how do you keep these different pressures on the machine in balance with each other, right? Which means you need to have like pressure valves and you need to have control mechanisms. Those are the things that we build, right? So we basically build mechanisms that anybody can deploy into their economy to like add like, you know, deflation for a period of time on a certain token over here, or rate limit like the distribution of a token so that like, you know, you can control the inflation rate you know, somewhere else. And those mechanisms, we generally tend to make them as decentralized as possible, which is the reason that we build on-chain games. And even the way that we build on-chain games isn't that like, you know, we go and like, you know, tailor like specific game mechanics based on the needs of our customers. We have a library of mechanics available, and then the people who use those mechanics can just sort of like put them together and then skin it however they want, whatever makes sense in their game universe, and run it inside their communities, right? So our principle, you know, if you think about sort of finance, the traditional world of finance and economics, The existence of blockchains decentralized the payment layer, right? It decentralized, like, you know, it decentralized the things that Visa and MasterCard and, like, you know, the banking APIs and stuff, what they do. But there's a layer on top of that that, you know, the central banks are responsible for, that the Federal Reserve is responsible for, that the Treasury is responsible for, which hasn't been decentralized yet. And that's what we're going after, right? So until now, the only people who've had to think about economies as sort of problems to solve are central bankers. They are the people who are setting economic policy, like, you know, in governments. But with digital communities now able to take control of, like, you know, their own economies, the communities themselves have to start thinking about these problems. And, you know, economists and bankers, like, you know, who are working for governments, they have their own set of tools and their own set of protocols that they use to enact their will on their economies. For digital communities that operate on blockchains, these tools don't exist, and those are the tools that we're building. So our policy is very much that, you know, we build smart contracts, we build APIs, and we make them easy for the, like, you know, Web3 communities to use, for Web3 games to use. But our involvement, it doesn't go, like, you know, beyond that. We don't want to advise them on what to do. We don't want to, like, it's really just about offering them the tools that help them manage their economies instead of, like, helping them manage their economies ourselves.
But there, how, I mean, I guess from what you're saying, it sort of sounds like you have some sort of, probably a terrible analogy, but you have some sort of off the shelf sort of valve systems or components or regulators or to continue your
regulators. I like
some,
that
sort
yeah.
of metaphor. So you have some sort of bits, some parts that you can sort of put in. So obviously every game is sort of to some degree is different, but then they can sort of come to you and you can go, here's our catalog of sort of
This is our menu. This is our menu of, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do you need deflation? These are the deflationary mechanisms, and this is how you.
Exactly. Okay, and generally, you'd always advise developers to sort of seek that sort of advice or look at those sort of options before they have a live game. But game developers, being game developers, obviously, probably they come to you a lot of the times when the thing's blowing up. I mean, is it a case of you can have something that's sort of live, and then you can sort of add these things into sort of live systems, or, you know, how do developers sort of do that? Because I can imagine, you know, some games have already got to the state where they've sort of blown up, then you're sort of coming in, and that's not just sort of adding some sort of limiter valve to stop the thing blowing up. I mean, the thing's blown up, so you sort of have to almost like restart it again from a, you know, a bit more of a fundamental point of view. So, how does that work out?
Yeah, actually, we never want to impose the restriction on someone that they have to be starting from scratch in order to use our product. And our product is really useful in those emergency situations, like, oh my God, we're on the verge of collapse. Like, you know, how do we make sure that we don't go to zero, or how do we make sure that, like, you know, our community isn't destroyed or something like that. Maybe it would help if I give you an example of, like, you know, what a mechanism looks like on Moonstream, right? Actually, I can use Crypto Unicorns again as an example. So post game launch, they have a couple of tokens in their economy. It was like a two token economy. There was the utility token. And there was no sync for the utility token. After we ran the on-chain game, Crypto Unicorns the Dark Forest, there was no sync for that token. And the only planned sync was going to be creating more unicorns, right? So the characters in Crypto Unicorns are unicorns. And when they started out, they had a population of 10,000 unicorns, but players could create more unicorns. They could breed unicorns to create new unicorns, and breeding unicorns was a sync for their utility token, right? And the inflation rate of the token was pretty high. And in order to just, like, they didn't want it to, like, go out of control, because it would have had, like, severe effects throughout the rest of their economy. Their target in the first month, they launched June of last year, something like that. And in the first, they expected in the first month of launch that they would double the population of unicorns. And I think about, like, 3 or 4 days in, like, you know, there had been barely any unicorns bred, like, maybe less than 100, right? So, like, less than 1% increase in the unicorn population. Yeah, less than 1%. So they were understandably worried. And so the solution was, like, you know, this is, again, where, like, our sort of platform comes in. because we, you know, because we collect live analytics from any of the blockchains that we support, we have like pretty up-to-date data on what players are doing. And, you know, what they, what you can do is you come in, you say, okay, these on-chain events should be worth this many points. Like you can make a mapping of like on-chain events and how many points they should be worth on a leaderboard. That creates a live leaderboard for like, you know, for your players. And then you can associate on-chain rewards with each of the leaderboard positions, right? So you, okay. So they came in and they said, okay, breeding two unicorns, that's worth 100 points, right? If you breed two unicorns and the offspring is like, you know, is rare or something, that's worth an additional 50 points. If you breed two unicorns and you get like some hidden class of offspring, that's worth 20 points, right? So they had like these point values that were associated with on-chain events that were coming automatically through our analytics feature. And they decided to run this like this leaderboard for, I think it was a month, mm-hmm. a month or 2 months. No, it was 1 month. Yeah. And at the end of that month, like whoever had the highest score on the leaderboard would get some like really amazing rewards, right? Mm-hmm. Getting onto the leaderboard required you to breed unicorns. And so that added as a net sink for unicorns. And doing, you know, you had sort of like an exponential distribution in terms of what kind of rewards people got, right? The people at the top got amazing rewards. The people further down the list got like, you know, pretty standard rewards, but people still wanted to compete. And this is where their game designers did a great job, right? They balanced the reward so that people wanted to compete for them. And we measured this because they ran these events like a few times and now they run them on an ongoing basis using our platform. At the times where the event was active, they actually hit 100% population increase per month on the unicorn population. And at times where the event was not active, they hit like a 20% population increase per month on the unicorn population, right? Mm-hmm. So basically like that entire event, which you can host, like, you know, using like just, it's an API call and a smart contract deployment away from Moonstream. It just turns on, it's basically a switch. When it's on, you have 100% population increase. When it's off, you have 20% population increase. And those are the kinds of mechanisms that I'm talking about, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is sort of interesting that the, you know, pretty much everyone now uses sort of a leaderboard system because that's obviously a way of rewarding tokens in a controlled manner. So you basically you have a fixed amount of tokens that are given out over what time frame, or it may not be tokens, maybe other things, but you typically have a fixed amount of tokens you put into a pool over a certain period of time. Doesn't matter how many people are playing that, you sort of have a sort of set reward. So it's not, so obviously you get away from the Axie Infinity, just log in and get some tokens because the tokens are locked into people doing stuff. So I think that's sort of become the standard thing everyone looks at. Yeah. But you know, as I say, that's sort of a trend that's happened because obviously we've gone through, you know, plenty of examples of blockchain games where the economy hasn't been thought through to any degree, and even somewhere it has been thought through to a little degree and still blown up for reasons outside their control. I mean, do you get the impression now that companies do have a good grasp of the sort of things they need to think about and the tooling they need to put in place and the sort of the levers they need to, one, to control it, and also, as you point out, to also open it up as well? I mean, do you think we've seen that level of sophistication sort of coming to the fore, or do you think there still is quite a lot of naivety?
Well, I think, you know, 5 years from now, we'll probably look back and think that there's a lot of naivety because we, you know, it's such a new space. We don't really know how to build decentralized games. We've never had to do that in the past. I mean, not since like we started building computer games anyway, like maybe Dungeons and Dragons was a decentralized game or is a decentralized. It used to be maybe, now it isn't, right? Now Wizards of the Coast controls it. But we just don't have much experience building such games and building such game worlds. So we're just learning a lot collectively, but there are projects that like put a lot of work into their economies that give themselves enough controls that they can make sure that the economies don't crash. And even then, sometimes it feels to me like a toss up whether it's going to happen or not. So our philosophy has always been, and you know, we try to stay away from like, you know, tokenomics modeling, simulation, stuff like that, because for the most part, you know, there's a quote, right? No plan survives first contact with the enemy. I think the same thing is true of like, you know, game design and tokenomics modeling, especially for something like a blockchain game. It's more important to have like good operational tools that'll help you sort of like influence your economy once it goes live than to have like a very comprehensive model for your economy before it goes live. It's, you know, I don't, so like Nassim Taleb, his series of books, I think is like, it's a pretty good series of books. There's one like really key central idea over there, which is that like, you know, so basically like he makes a distinction between mediocristan, like, you know, situations where things follow like normal distributions, where the law of large numbers applies and stuff like that. And then, sort of black swan type scenarios where you don't really know, like, you know, what kind of operations you're operating under. And there's like a great deal of asymmetry between like positive and negative outcomes, or like, you know, outcomes of different types. And when you're dealing with an economy, you're naturally subject to like those kinds of black swan dynamics. And most modeling that goes on around economies doesn't really account for those kinds of factors. And so personally, I don't believe too much in modeling and simulation. I don't give it like a lot of weight. I give more weight to robust sort of controls and like healing mechanisms for an economy. And that's what we focus on anyways.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in general, I mean, anecdotally, I sort of see now that a lot of people who maybe said they had tokens and maybe will have tokens are very much not launching tokens until their game is live. And you sort of see, obviously, the behavior of players will change once tokens are in there, but at least you can get some idea of sort of the general patterns of how people are playing your game. Without tokens, just in there. And then you can sort of maybe, you know, as you say, have leaderboards that where tokens are given out, and you sort of have a very small sort of initial sort of supply, and so you see how that falls through. I mean, it's kind of funny, sort of back in the day, so I got into the sort of blockchain sort of games market in sort of 2018 with the whole sort of CryptoKitties thing. And it was sort of funny that I remember all the, you know, how seriously, me being naive here, how seriously you sort of, you took white papers and you sort of print them all out and read them and annotate them. And then, you know, it's sort of, you know, but it's sort of, even from the tokenomics, from modeling tokenomics point of view, whether you people to take it seriously or not, or the actual control of it. You know, white paper, people don't really do them anymore, do they? But it's pointless. It's absolutely pointless. Yeah. You can put together a rough vision of sort of how you think some of the things are going to combine together, but
I wouldn't say it's pointless because the white papers are what invite people into your community, and so in a sense they actually matter a lot. But But ultimately, all that matters once your game is live or close to being live is the code, right? That's like really, really what matters is the code, and really what matters is how robust your code is, or how either how robust or how anti-fragile, if you can make it that way, right? that's ultimately our goal.
Cool. And in terms of obviously we've been for the last sort of year or so now in a bear market where prices of everything have sort of collapsed, and you know, we've started to see sort of generally at the high level sort of a lot of the sort of exchanges and stuff have problems. Not so much on the game side, I see, although we are, you know, I sort of track this sort of stuff, and we are starting to see sort of games now just sort of run out of funds and that sort of stuff as well. I mean, from someone who's sort of seeing that from the business sort of point of view, in terms of sort of clients onboarding and having to, obviously you're charging them money and stuff. How do you see the sort of state of play in the blockchain game industry at the moment?
Money is definitely drying up. You know, projects are like watching their runways. Projects are watching like their spend. It's a pretty tough time in crypto in general, like, you know, blockchain projects in general. There are going to be injections of liquidity, like, you know, all these ETFs, like Bitcoin ETFs and stuff like that. I'm not sure how much of that liquidity is going to come to like the decentralized application ecosystem or the decentralized gaming ecosystem, just because, like, if you're managing Bitcoin on an ETF, like, you're probably not using that nobody's using that money to buy ordinals or whatever, right? Like, it's just that's just going to be soaking up like liquidity on the blockchain. So it's not clear, like, you know, when there's going to be an end in sight for people who are actually building applications over here. Definitely things are drying up. It's like a pretty tough market. I was around like for the last bear market, and this one feels like a lot worse.
But I guess it sort of feels a lot worse because there were a lot more. I mean, I'm sort of tracking around a sort of 1,000 blockchain games to some degree. Which you could argue is far too many. It's not, you know, I don't know how many blockchain games we need, but it's sort of it's sort of interesting that maybe we had overexpansion now, and so maybe it seems worse because because last time around, if 50% of the blockchain games went bust, that was maybe 100, whereas now if 50% go bust, that's 500.
You know, it's interesting about blockchain games, though, because I think that most people think about blockchain games like sort of in a very old-fashioned way. I mean, old-fashioned for crypto. Like, they're thinking of it in a very 2020 way or a very 2017 way. You know, a lot of people who are building blockchain games are thinking, I'm going to create, like, you know, here's my tokens, you know, here's my entire new game world, and, you know, here's how it's going to work, and I'm going to do this big launch, and I'm going to make millions of dollars. Well, in this market, you're not going to make millions of dollars. You're going to make substantially less than that. Good luck doing a token sale, because the SEC is breathing down your neck. You know, I hope you're not based in the US. There's all these issues, right? But there are a lot of communities out there, like, you know, even just PFPs, right? Where there are people who hold tokens who are actually pretty engaged with the ideas of the communities. Where, you know, they would appreciate like a small little casual game that they could play, or like they would appreciate just some gaming utility or the assets that they already hold. I'm actually kind of surprised that we aren't seeing more of that. We do that. I mean, that's like something that we talk to. Even if somebody isn't, like, let's say somebody has like an NFT collection, but they're not a gaming studio. They can still like deploy on-chain games that provide like some value and some engagement for like, you know, their user base. And so we're quite open to working with projects like that. I'm curious why we're not seeing more game developers go after existing assets, right? Like, why not create a game for Bored Ape holders or like, you know, someone like that instead of like starting a project from scratch? That's something that I think we will see more and more of, but I'm sort of surprised that we haven't seen more of it already.
Although it's interesting, because the obviously Yuga have their own sort of big game metaverse sort of thing, and it's been interesting over the last week. Obviously, NFTs have been absolutely slammed.
Yeah,
really, for what's been going on with the Mizuki collection, as well as sort of macro stuff. But I've definitely seen plenty of people on Twitter who have been Bored Ape holders complaining that Yuga is reducing the value of their beautiful PFPs by making not very good games. It's sort of interesting that I think some of the NFT holders actually think game utility actually. It sort of stops the abstract purity of sort of the
interesting
what the concept is. So it's kind of an interesting sort of split there. And I definitely know from back in the day when, you know, it actually did get really big, that none of the PFP, or not none of them, but very few PFP collectors got into Axies because they didn't like the fact that
it's generally true. Like, because I've been involved in a lot of like, you know, NFT token sales for games.
Yeah.
Your tokens lose a lot of value once the game goes live, right? Like that's like universally been true in my experience. Yeah. That is an interesting thing. But you know, the interesting, like the other thing about Yuga and Bored Apes is so far Yuga has been driving the game development. I don't know what the usage rights are, like, you know, in terms of licensing for Bored Apes. I think it's pretty permissive, but I'm not sure. You can build permissionlessly. Like, you know, you don't have to be associated with Yuga to build a game for Bored Ape holder. Then, yeah, sure, Yuga does benefit, and the Bored Apes community, like, you know, does benefit from, like, you know, you creating, let's say that you made a good game, not some crappy game, but a good game for that collection. You can charge a fee for people to enter your game and play it. And if it's good enough, you know, I guess people would do that. And Yuga benefits, but so do you, because you don't have to go and, like, chase down, like, build a totally new player base from scratch. You have an existing community that's engaged with the assets that's sort of like, you know, ready to play your content. So, you know, in some sense, Bored Ape holders can't stop someone from building games for Bored Apes. Yeah. And that's sort of like the angle that I would like to see people adopt, the game developers adopt, and say, you know, we're going to take a risk and build a game for Bored Apes. You know, it'll be good. And if you like it, play it and speak with your, you know, speak with your transactions and not with your mouths, basically.
A few episodes back, I was talking to the guys who are building Serum City, which is a sort of it's more on the mutant side. They're a mutant, the mutant DAO, mutant cartel, they're called. So they're building something interesting towards the end of the year. I guess one of the issues is if you have even what is now a fairly expensive NFT, you don't necessarily want to be connecting your wallet to, oh, here's some game you can play, connect your wallet with your expensive NFTs into my smart contract.
Actually, this is
people just like, why would I risk it? So there's maybe on the, but I do definitely agree with you that I think some of these NFT collections sort of really get sort of ground down.
Yeah.
That there is some sort of you can see the potential for someone to sort some sort of roll up sort of, you can imagine some sort of Smash Brothers thing where you have a whole bunch of, pretty much, 100 NFT collections. If you've got these things lying around that you can't really sell anymore, but you can have sort of bring the community in there. There's some sort of meta game. I'm sure people are thinking around that. It's sort of quite a lot of interest around that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of problems to solve there, assets and how do you make all the game, all of the collections work in a single, let's say that you're building a console game or a computer, how do you make that work? There's a lot of problems to solve, but I really think that that's the future, right? Because you have these, the hardest thing as someone, as someone who writes software and sells software, is how do you build your user base? For game developers, it's even harder because you're competing with so many other people for the attention of players. And the one of the great things about Web3 is that there's no moat. Nobody has a moat around their players anymore. Yeah. Literally, that information is public. I know it because some of our customers use that information to attract players into their game worlds. It's a big deal. I just don't understand why more people are not making use of it. I'm genuinely curious, actually. Yeah. And I expect that to change, over the next year or so.
Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say necessarily coming to the end, but we've done a whole chunk of stuff. I realize we haven't really actually spoken very much about sort of Moonstream, and maybe it's a good opportunity to maybe talk a little bit about sort of what you guys have been up to recently, and sort of what your plans are for the rest of the year. I mean, obviously you're there sort of supporting the sort of ecosystem in it, and to a degree you know what developers want is sort of probably what you end up doing, but what are from a company and tech point of view, what are the things you're sort of looking at to be doing over the next sort of 6 months?
We're working on the next version of our product. So far, the way that people use our products is from the command line by API calls and stuff. It's it's extremely technical and inaccessible to most people. And the people who end up using us, our sort of most valuable user is game designers. So we're working on building a nice front end around it and sort of making that'll go live in the next month. We're rolling it out gradually, so the first part of it is already live, and then it'll go live. It'll be complete over the next month. And then besides that, we're looking very closely at the Ordinals ecosystem. A very exciting blockchain for us, just mm-hmm. because that's the blockchain, right? That's the blockchain that everyone starts on. And Ordinals is exciting for us because it brings it brings the possibility of games to Bitcoin, to people who are exclusively in the Bitcoin ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so we're launching this project called Ethereal NFTs. So it's a way basically to create EVM, to create ERC-721 tokens on any EVM chain that mirror a digital asset anywhere else, right? As long as there's some sort of authority, like blockchain ownership or something like that, that can certify that a given person holds a digital asset, that person can mirror that asset on an EVM chain, on Polygon or any L2s, L3s, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And open them up for game utility. One of the problems it solves is the one that you mentioned, where let's say that you have a wallet that has a bunch of high value assets. You don't want to be signing a bunch of transactions with that account just to play a game. But with Ethereals, what you'll be able to do is you'll be able to create a short-lived mirror of let's say a Bored Ape or something, play games with that mirror, and then once it's done, put it in some burner account or something, and once it's done, forget about it. So that's something that we're going to be launching in July. The first project that'll be using it is called Metaboy. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but Metaboy.run is the first project that'll be using it. So pretty excited about that. And then those are the generally growing the business.
Cool. Good. And for people who want to find out more, obviously, I guess Moonstream website is the sort of place to go. You're on Twitter.
To the moon. So moonstream.to is the website.
To. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Good. Yep. I think that's I think we've covered everything we need to cover. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
And thank you to you for watching or listening, however you're consuming the podcast. I hope you are subscribed. Every episode, we are talking to the people who are sort of deep into this new sort of world of building games, as sort of we've been discussing. This is, you don't need this sort of infrastructure when you're building centralized games, which is why this is both difficult and I think exciting. So I hope you are enjoying it as much as I am. Don't forget to subscribe. We've got a whole bunch of episodes already lined up, so some good ones coming. I won't spoil the surprise, but we are getting busy. So I guess the meme is in the bear market everyone should be building, and I guess for blockchain gaming podcast, when we're in the bear market, blockchain gaming podcast should be doing more episodes. So hopefully we're doing that. But see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.